Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what we see is happening in the world today. We talk about where we think the world is going, and we talk about the future, and we're not afraid to take a rather unusual view of those matters. We think there's a pretty good case to be made that the world might just be getting better all the time. We think that if you're not excited about the future, maybe you're just not paying attention. And we believe that something is going to happen. Something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and returning to me after his long absence from the virtual chat room is my co-host, co-blogger, and co-futurist, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen. How are you? Happy New Year.
Well, thanks, Phil. Yeah, an absence of 1 week. That's what qualifies as a long absence.
That is an extended absence. No, I have to say I did that special half-hour show on Friday, and that was the loneliest 30 minutes of my life.
Well, you did awesome. You did awesome. I have yet to attempt a solo show. Just, you know, if you ever get in trouble and you got somebody else on the line, you know, you just throw the ball to them, and they pick it up and run with it. And with a solo show, you're just out there. And so congratulations on your courage with that, Phil. And it was a good show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It was actually kind of fun to do. And I had the one thing that made it possible, I think, to do that was I had far more material than you and I could ever have covered even in a two-hour show, much less a 30-minute show. So I was never in any danger of running out of things to say. As soon as I thought I was going to run out of something to say, I just boom on to the next one. For those listening who don't know what we're talking about, the special edition of Fast Forward Radio that we did this past Friday was just a quick run-through of our Better All the Time year in summary. It was the top 50 good news stories of the year, and I did my best to read through all 50 of those in 30 minutes. And actually, it took me about 34 minutes, so I didn't quite succeed, but came fairly close.
It was great. It was real good.
Well, thanks. We've also got Michael Darling with us, our chat host. Michael, how are you?
I'm good. Good evening.
You know what's great about this is we've got a really big special program, Michael, and you and I don't have to waste any time at all tonight talking about the Broncos.
The who?
Exactly. Exactly. So that's all over with, and we can move on to the program, and it is a very exciting, very special show that we have tonight. Stephen, I'm going to turn it over to you. You can talk about who we've got on the program and go ahead and bring out our panel and introduce them.
Absolutely. We have got three great guests tonight. The first is Jeff Hilford. He's the CEO and co-founder of Memebox, LLC. He's been carrying around a vision of the multimedia network for the future for a number of years. He traveled out to Los Angeles in 2006. All right, we are back on, and I believe that we may have lost the section of the show, Phil, where I introduced our guests. Should I do that again?
Well, why don't we just say that we've got Jeff Hilford, Alvis Bridges, and Gary Golden from Memebox on the program this evening. We're delighted to have all three of them on the show, and we've got more biographical information and pictures of them on the website, just so we avoid repeating ourselves, I think.
Absolutely.
So, once again, gentlemen, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you. Thanks again.
Hi, guys. Yeah, thanks for having us.
we're totally thrilled to have you. And we're getting word from chat room that the audio is back. So welcome back, listeners. And we're going to start out. We're going to do our 2-to-1 feature. Here's what we want to do. Oh, I also wanted to mention we were looking forward to having Marissa, and I've never pronounced her name out loud. Is it Vitals? Is that correct?
It's Vitals.
VTOLs. Thank you for correcting me on that. Marissa was planning to join us. Had some family medical stuff going on. Not able to make it. So we're all the best to her and her family. Looking forward to having her on some other evening. Which means that, as is so often the case tonight, Fast Forward Radio will be just us guys. So except for I'm sure some of the folks listening. Now I'm going to take us through 2-1. This is the game show portion of the program. I'm going to introduce three news stories to you. I'll read through them briefly, and here's the trick. These are all news stories related to science, related to technology, somehow related to the future. Two of them are true. One of them is false, and your challenge will be to identify the fake news story. And Michael will also look for our listeners in the chat room to cast their votes as to which one they think is a fake, and I will give a big reveal at the end of the program. Okay, so here are our three stories. Number one, the MIT project uses nanotech to deliver drugs for fighting cancer and AIDS. Researchers at MIT are using nanoparticles, infrared light, and self-propelled robotic nanoscale devices as part of a project to develop a more accurate method of delivering multiple drugs to patients battling diseases such as cancer and AIDS. The researchers have created differently shaped nanoparticles that are each designed to release their medicinal payloads at different times. According to MIT, the new drug delivery system is controlled by a nanoscale electronic and mechanical delivery mechanism which is used to provide patients with up to 3 or 4 drugs at a time. With a lot of diseases, especially cancer and AIDS, you get a synergistic effect with more than one drug. Kimberly Hamad Shifterly, an assistant professor of biological and mechanical engineering at MIT, said in a statement, MIT noted in an announcement about the research effort that doctors already use drug delivery devices, but that the existing ones generally can release only 2 drugs at a time, and the timing of the medicine's release typically has to be built into the delivery device itself without the flexibility of the programmable robotic system. Okay, so that's item one, MIT using nanotechnology robots to fight cancer and AIDS. Item two, scientists discover true love. This is... nice one with Valentine's Day coming up in about 6 weeks. Scientists have discovered true love. Brain scans have proved that a small number of couples can respond with as much passion after 20 years as most people exhibit only in the first flush of love. The findings overturn the conventional view that love and sexual desire peak at the start of a relationship and then decline as the years pass. A team from Stony Brook University in New York scanned the brains of couples who had been together for 20 years and compared them with those of new lovers. They found that about 1 in 10 of the mature couples exhibited the same chemical reactions when shown photographs of their loved ones as people commonly do in the early stages of a relationship. So, the enduring power of love, item two. Okay, now, item three, how crabs find their way home. Path integration may not be as widely known as the American Express card, but you'd better not leave the house without it. After all, path integration is the ability of animals, including humans, to return home from somewhere else. How animals keep their bearings on hunting trips is somewhat of a mystery. Celestial navigation and electromagnetic fields help ants, honeybees, birds, and sea turtles keep track of directions. More puzzling, how animals measure distances. A new study has found the first direct evidence that fiddler crabs monitor their travels by tracking their strides. The results, set to be published next month in Current Biology, indicate that fiddler crabs perform sophisticated math whenever they leave home. We think they're summing steps, says senior study author John Lane, a biologist at the University of Cincinnati. They know how many strides they've taken and the length of each, and that magic number gives them their distance from home. Okay, so there's your three stories. You've got crabs who are counting their steps to keep track of their way home. You've got true love that lasts forever with some couples. And you've got MIT using nanotechnology, robotics, and electronics to fight cancer and AIDS. And we will check back in on those three stories as we approach the end of the program. All right, so let's jump in, and we want to talk with our meme box friends. And I think, Jeff, why don't I give the first question to you? Can you just tell us what is meme?
Meme box is a platform where people can come together. It's an open platform for the discussion of the future. It's a combination of bottom up and top down. So we've got experts on there talking about the future in a number of different fields, and we try and provide an atmosphere for anybody to come in and discuss their visions of the of the future. And our goal is really to really make the future more accessible and translative to the broader public, and try and take a lot of all the great stuff that's happening at the edge of science and bring it, make it more accessible to the public. So I think that's a decent description of it. And I think ultimately one of our goals is to create an ongoing simulation of the future, sort of using that combination of experts and crowdsourcing.
You know, that's interesting. Phil, at Convergence 08, there's actually a discussion between some of the conference goers there about whether it's important to involve the larger public in these future issues, or whether it should be just the domain of you know, futurists. And remarkably enough, there was actually a bit of a controversy over that. I don't see why there should be any controversy. I think we need to involve the public as much as possible.
And in fact, that was where Elvis and Marissa came right back in at the end of my talk, and representing the meme box view, said, "Hey, you know, this is crazy. Of course, we want everyone thinking about, talking about, and involved in helping to create the future." So, what are the pieces of meme box that make it? There's kind of several sites within the sort of meme box universe, and what are those?
Well, go ahead.
Oh, sure. The different pieces that we've got going are Future Blogger, and those are. That's a set of blogs that we either run top down, and we've got two really great ones. We've got the Future of Gadgets and the Energy Roadmap, for which Gary's the founding editor. We've got those, and they work together with people's bottom up submissions as well. So you can take cross posts from your home future blog and post them on Memebox, and then see how people respond over there. Then the second part that we have is called Future Scanner, and that is a clearinghouse for all future related information on the web. It's very much like a dig clone or a stumble upon, and dedicated explicitly to future focusing, and the information that also goes in through our Future Blogger network goes through Future Scanner. So you can either consume stuff directly by reading our posts. Or you can go to Future Scanner and just kind of search by year and category very easily. It's kind of a first place anyone researching the future, or a futurist, kind of working on a project, or a college kid, trying to figure out what they want to study in college, should go to and just click on the years or categories and see what different people are saying about the future. And, to circle back to the initial point about why it's good to crowdsource the future, Surowiecki in Wisdom of the Crowd says that it's very important to have a diverse set of brains that are all informed. And when it comes to the various problem sets that we're faced with in the world, especially the world of accelerating change, my contention, and I know Marissa agreed with this, is certainly that different people are going to have competencies in different areas, and only by integrating all of those perspectives can we stitch together the most effective holistic simulation of the future. So, a future blog and a future scanner are kind of a first stab at accomplishing that.
It's very interesting stuff. And Elvis, one of the pieces that you and I talked a little bit about, and that I made a contribution to, is Scenario Land. How does it fit into the overall meme box structure?
Scenario Land is also is one of the blogs that we have going right now. It lives on. It's our little black sheep blog that gets fewer submissions, but is highly interesting. Scenario Land is a forum intended for more for speculation and for fiction scenarios and kind of for throwing ideas out there that might not be as credible or as rigorously researched as the other blogs.
How many do y'all have participating at this time?
As far as, are you talking about from a people visiting the Meanbox network itself, or people actually submitting, contributing, et cetera?
Well, I guess my question, I meant contributing, but as far as your outreach goes, I guess you can answer both questions. How many folks do y'all have contributing at this time?
I think that I couldn't give you an exact number on that, but I can say that so far it's been pretty reflective of what we've set out to achieve.
Yeah.
There's a handful of, we've got a bunch of people who are sort of top down within the Meanbox structure itself. We've got a number of regular cross posters, some of whom are futurists and run active blogs elsewhere. And we're beginning to see more and more people, who are just submitting their thoughts in original blog posts. So I think the community from that standpoint, like any sort of community, is growing slowly. But the attention that we get sort of from the broader web is pretty active. And I think we feel like it's kind of hitting that sort of tipping point, critical mass, or at least we hope so.
Phil and I are going to need to start cross-posting, I think.
Yeah, we would love to have you guys on there, that's for sure.
Well, and we have seen some of our material has been linked over there. We need to get busy, Stephen, and making sure that we take responsibility for that and getting some of our stuff on there. Now, I see Meanbox described as a startup. Is that an analogy, or is this intended actually as a business? And if so, can you say something about what the business model is for something like Meanbox?
Our intention is that is to develop this into a full-fledged future media network. Obviously, it's a difficult climate for anyone with the startup moniker right now. But I think clearly there's an opportunity for businesses like Meanbox to enter the market, and the popular mindset. And I think that a lot of other similar businesses, dedicated to topics, ranging from plumbing to education to politics, are going to start to emerge from the web blocks that are now available to, the average person, which are things that we look at as kind of basic technologies, such as these dig clones and blog networks and things like that. But I think we're banking on the fact that this is going to become a monetizable new frontier, and I hope that it becomes so also for a whole host of domain areas.
Well, certainly we've decided to hold off on an IPO for the speculative at this time. we can be convinced otherwise. Certainly, as some of these others start to pick up some speed. But seriously, I love the things that you're doing. A lot of this obviously is right up our alley, right along the same kinds of things that we've been trying to do. Particularly, Future Scanner, which is something that Stephen and I have talked about quite a bit. How could you get something like that going? And a couple of years ago, we put a web app up that was intended to allow that, but it was kind of a clunky interface and it didn't work very well. So it's great to see that these ideas are evolving and that people are getting more and more opportunities to share information, to have an environment where they can go discuss the future. It's really very exciting to see something like this coming along.
I think that's a good point also, Phil. It's one of the main reasons we started this is to bring together a bunch of the voices that are out there. Working independently, I think for me personally, being at a bunch of conferences and rubbing elbows with people who I felt were doing groundbreaking work and also felt like some of their ideas and their content wasn't getting out to a broader populace. I think that's part of the appeal of Future Scanner and that we're hoping that that people do come together and make it a greater place and increase. It's a place where someone like you guys can increase your personal reach And the future scanner itself, I mean, that's one of the beauties of it, is that, you know, you're looking for a particular type of content. And you say that there's a lot of crossover and idea sharing, and that's another reason that we created it, and the value of it is to have a place, sort of a one-stop shopping, or a place that you can add to your reader that brings together, you know, future-focused material, a bunch of it, and, you know, sorts it by future year, which is one of the really great aspects of the future scanner. If you want to search what people are talking about for, you know, year and category, it's a great way to approach it.
Could you gentlemen share some of the predictions that have been made, maybe some of the ones that were right and maybe some of the ones that were wrong in an entertaining way? There's just some examples.
Sure. I mean, you know, now that it's the beginning of the year, we were just looking at some of the predictions that were made a year ago and checking out how accurate they were. One of the ones that entered Future Scanner was Bush predicts Mideast peace pact by 2009. I think that, you know, the current climate in Israel contradicts that prediction, so that's a fail.
Yeah.
Another one was that the subprime crisis won't peak until 2009. Now, I think we all hope that is inaccurate, but that's looking like it's going to be accurate as, you know, more and more foreclosures on homes take place. And then, you know, in the same vein, there was another one where Jerome Apari predicted investment banking crash by 2009. And I think that is one of the more prescient and more risky predictions to find its way into the future scanner, and absolutely was proved accurate. So, you know, that's just a taste of kind of the stuff that you would get if you just searched for 2009. You'd get a spread of inaccurate and accurate predictions, but then, you know, it's incumbent on you to pick the ones that, you know, you think are relevant.
So not taking those three as necessarily representative, but it's interesting that two of them had to do with the financial world, and, you know, our Nassim and Nicholas Taleb and his black swans notwithstanding, is it possible that that world is easier to predict than, say, the volatile conditions in the Middle East? Just looking at those three, is there a conclusion to be drawn about things that are easier or harder to predict, or would that be making too big of an assumption from so few data points?
I think it would be probably too much of an assumption to make from that. I think there are certainly an awful lot of minds that are devoted, and probably as a result, an awful lot of predictions that you know, about the financial world. You know, Peter Schiff is another guy who's been out there recently, who's gotten a lot of credit for calling us, you know, a bunch of these things that happen. But I think one of the interesting things too, when you bring up the Black Swan book, is that it actually deals with both of those, because you know, Nassim Taleb's background is he's, you know, he's Lebanese, and part of the grounding, I think, of a lot of his thinking comes from you know, a Lebanon that was seemingly, you know, a very stable place and fell apart very quickly. So and he's a guy who's obviously talks, you know, a lot about the Black Swan model as the way it applies to finance. So it's kind of an interesting way those three things tie together.
You look at the financial crisis, and that one would be, I think, hard to classify as a Black Swan, just because it would seem that, I mean, I didn't hear a lot of people predicting it, but it looks in retrospect so utterly predictable that it would have happened. Of course, you know, that's how the past often looks, I guess, from our privileged vantage point of the future here, where we live.
Actually, Taleb himself mentioned that he did not consider that to be a black swan; that he considered that so obvious that it wasn't. So he agrees with you exactly, Phil.
We might need to define black swan for our audience.
Well, a black swan is, very generally speaking, a huge disruption that is more or less generally more unpredictable. That though it's not likely to occur, it's still very necessary to incorporate into our estimations of the future because of the huge impact that such an event could have. So let's just say that, you know, there's only a 2% chance that a black swan event will occur in a given area. Nevertheless, it might be we might make the right decision to invest more than 2% of our resources into preparing for that future, because if that occurs, then, you know, we could lose, you know, a much higher percentage of value in that area, or we could gain from that.
And this is Gary. So black swan, you know, is a term that that has, you know, been popular lately, but it's really the wild card is the, you know, the historical future term of the low probability high impact events.
Right.
That's a more eloquent way of putting it.
Yeah.
And the more colloquial way of talking about it, I think that, you know, the analogy that he uses in the book is the turkey, every day, and it's out of day.
And I believe we seem to be having an audio problem. You might want to repeat what you just said, because I got every other word.
Ooh, okay. Are you hearing me okay?
I'm hearing you good
now. I think it sounds good now.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I was just saying, from a colloquial standpoint, the way that Taleb describes it is, as the 1,000th and first day, that the life of a turkey over 1,000 days, you know, has a human being taking care of it every day, and every day is the same. And the 1,000th, you know, and the 1,000th and first day is the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and everything changes.
I'm glad I got to repeat that. I was worth hearing.
That really sums it up. All those wonderful days of being fed and well cared for indicate nothing whatsoever about what future lies in store for that turkey. And in fact, the notion of black swan comes from the idea of whether all the observations throughout history of white swans gave us any indication as to whether we would ever see a black one, right? I think that's the original kind of conundrum that was being dealt with. Although it's much more dramatic when you put it in terms of the life of the turkey. That's awesome. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Jeff Alvis and Gary from MemeBox. If you're listening live and would like to join our discussion, we have a live online chat. You can also leave comments at the blog. And we're going to be getting into a little bit of energy discussion now. And for that, I think we'll turn the discussion over a bit towards Gary Golden, who is listed here as our energy policy expert. And Gary, let me just throw this out to you. What would you say, looking back on 2008, and of course we're going to be making our predictions for 2009 and beyond towards the end of the program, but what would you say were the big developments on the energy front for the year just passed?
Well, I think the big stories were, obviously the rise and fall of the price of oil. But now that we've kind of ended the year on a very different note than what we started, I think if we looked back at 2008 and said what was the most important story of the year, would be the signal from the automobile industry that we're at the beginning of the end of the combustion engine. So every major automobile maker has made an announcement to have planned production vehicles sometime around 2010, 2013. So we can look at this as a multi-decade transition, but in 2008, we saw the beginning of the end of the combustion engine. So that would be the big story of 2008.
And that's huge.
It's gigantic. I mean, the last 100 years were built, one of the greatest technology platforms of the 20th century was the combustion engine. and to see the end of that era is very significant. So beyond the automobile industry, the other big stories were the recognition that plant-based biofuels, such as corn ethanol and soy-based biodiesel, are really not going to be the platforms for growth of the future. And the ideas that are now starting to become more mainstream, you know, based on the notion of tapping microbes, so algae and bacteria. So, you know, looking back at 2008, you can say that corn and plant-based biofuels really kind of peaked and plateaued as a future possibility.
I noticed something when I was fueling my car the other day. On the side of the pump, it showed 10% ethanol. You know, may contain 10% ethanol, and there was a little logo showing an ear of corn. And I thought to myself, that logo is gonna change. Whether or not they move away from corn, they're not gonna advertise that it's gonna be corn any longer.
Yeah, the press has been very bad, and I think we're at a different level of that conversation.
Yeah.
And then I just think, you know, the final, you know, real kind of, I think, shift story for 2008 was the emergence of new leadership. So you'd seen from Silicon Valley and places like Hawaii and Europe and even Asia, the rise of, you know, new clean tech missionaries and visionaries, people that are not necessarily industry veterans, but have a very different vision of what the energy sector could look like in the next 50 to 100 years, and these people are now gaining more widespread attention. So I think that, you know, the leadership story from 2008 is very significant as well.
Gary, we get we have a regular feature we run called Better All the Time, where we sum up important positive news developments, and the one we did right before the end of the year, before I did my year in review summary, the lead story there was about a company that is producing ethanol from algae, and the numbers that they're showing are just so impressive. The company's called Alginol, when you look at the rate of return in terms of how much energy you get per, you know, acre or per pound or however you want to do the math, it's just astounding. I mean, not only compared to ethanol produced from corn, but compared to a lot of other ways that you might go about trying to provide fuel. And I wonder, what would you say are the major roadblocks for companies that are trying to get moving with these kinds of solutions? It seems like that ought to happen a lot faster than we see it happening.
Sure. So just real quickly to give those ratios, generally speaking, if you looked at, you know, corn versus a unit, let's say an acre, you would get maybe 20 gallons of gasoline per year, liquid fuel. If you looked at soy, you might get 70 per unit. If you went with Jatropha or some other non-food crop, you might get 500. And then with palm, you would get, let's say, 700 to 900. Gallons of liquid fuel. With algae, you're looking at 5,000 to 25,000 gallons per year per unit. So it is orders of magnitude greater than plant-based energy conversion. The challenges for algae are very clear, and the industry is on the same page in terms of what needs to happen. The first is species selection. So we need to find out what algae lines are good at growing in specific environments. So if you're looking to have an algae plant retrofitted on a corn power plant in Arizona versus Saudi Arabia or the middle of Russia, you're going to need a different species. So we need to get the species. And then we need to look at growing conditions, and that involves light, temperature, supplement nutrients, the rate of exchange and flow of the water, a whole number of grow environment factors. And once they get those two things together, then it's just a matter of scaling up. And that really involves creating a physical infrastructure that can be retrofitted onto a carbon-rich factory or power plant and actually make it work. So scaling is, you know, the big hurdle.
I suppose genetic modification of the algae lines is a big, big part of this.
Yeah, that's the one where, you know, we're certainly at liberty to talk about that on this show, but you don't find it as much in mainstream media. But, you know, the end game with algae is to create synthetically designed species that are designed to maximize their, you know, carbon conversion. And those companies are the ones that are really likely to change the game in the biofuel sector. So that would be like LS9 and Synthetic Genomics, which is run by Craig Venter.
When you look at the challenges that lie ahead for your for clean tech missionaries and visionaries, for folks who are trying to really push these ideas out there, is it going to be a harder environment for them now that the price of oil has dropped so drastically? Is that going to make it a more challenging environment for them?
Well, I mean, the drop in the price of oil, I think the biggest implication is, you know, a lack of geopolitical stability. I don't think that long-term investments in alternative fuels are going to be distracted by the cost of oil. I think the main change in the game plan of the lower cost of oil is alternative hydrocarbons, so tar sands and oil shale and things like that. I think investments in solar and, you know, electron-based energy production they will continue as long as money is available. The challenge that I see with clean tech missionaries is that the question will be, when will the incumbents jump in? So, you know, a good example is back in the mid-90s, everybody wanted to be a biotech hub. So every city in America wanted to be a biotech center. But at the end of the day, it came down to which regions had the core capabilities. So I think that, you know, California, Silicon Valley has a great chance to flex its muscle with some forms of energy, clean tech products and services. But I think it's going to be Houston and Detroit in the end that are going to really grow alternative energy industries. So I think their greatest challenge is going to be competition from the incumbents, not the lack of capital.
Before we move on from energy, I thought we might want to mention real quick some of the developments about getting the hydrogen out of water. That's happened this year as well, hasn't it?
Yeah. So the big story, I think, one of the big stories of 2009 is going to be energy storage. Everyone focuses on energy production, but it's really energy storage is the most disruptive new element to the energy puzzle. And if you look at energy storage via batteries and things of that nature, you're really dealing with bad chemistry and a ceiling in performance. There's nothing better than storing energy in the form of chemical bonds. And hydrogen is a wonderful way to store energy in the form of a chemical bond. So the ability to convert water from using electricity into hydrogen is a ratio that in the end, with nanostructured catalysts and things like that, will likely be, you know, roughly 1-to-1. And the big story this past year was the breakthrough with a low-cost catalyst from Professor Dan Nocera at MIT developed a very effective low-cost method of storing energy in the form of hydrogen.
Yeah, we talked about that one a couple of times on the program. We look at hydrogen as possibly being kind of the battery of the future. It's storage and transport mechanism for going forward for energy. Well, let's turn this around a little bit and looking ahead now. For 2009, what do you see coming? What do you think are likely major developments in the energy sector for the coming year?
So I think 2009, the big story is going to be the smart grid. I think you're going to see a lot of investments from the government and also from utilities in making the electrical grid smarter and more resilient. So the three pieces of the smart grid then are software, sensors, and storage. So software to make utilities more aware of peak demand and better manage their energy flows. Sensors located along the grid will help them anticipate any potential disruptions. and then storage at the local end will help utilities manage these ebbs and flows in demand. So if you look at the federal government and where they're going to spend money in infrastructure, I think a large portion of those dollars are going to go towards bringing the electrical grid up to speed.
How long term of a project is that, and how smart does the grid get? How fast, and what kind of savings do we see over the short term?
It's going to take a long time. So, and utilities are among the least innovative companies within the energy sector. So, the cost savings are tremendous. So, if you can build fewer plants, we have plenty of power plants in this country and around the world. We just don't have a way to store the electricity. So, I think the cost incentives are there. But you're probably looking at a 10 to 20 year process of really changing how the grid works.
I was able to see T. Boone Pickens give a presentation here in Shreveport a couple months back, and the smart grid was actually a very important part of what he was talking about. He spent a lot of time talking about, and that's a necessity for his particular vision of the future.
Yeah, no, it's the future is powered by electricity, not oil. The only thing in our world that's really still powered by hydrocarbon directly is the vehicle, the combustion engine. So we really need to be paying more attention to the electrical grid.
And you see that changing, starting to move away from that already in 2008. How does 2009 look for electric vehicles?
I think what happens in 2009 is that, the U.S. kind of has a shock to its image of the future. And I think in 2009, we're going to see Asia dominating the electric car industry. So the key to electric vehicles is energy storage, and the first generation electric vehicles are going to be based off of batteries. And then as we move on to second and third generation electric vehicles, we're going to integrate batteries, hydrogen fuel cells, and capacitors into one unit. So there is not one storage device that's going to solve all our problems with vehicles. We're going to need to integrate all three. But in 2009, I think that the U.S. is going to be playing catch-up to Asian battery manufacturers who are going to start scaling up their production of lithium-ion batteries.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
So the
sad part is that the electric vehicle does not give us energy independence. And we trade... We trade oil for batteries. The U.S. has a very low core competency when it comes to energy storage. So,
and then beyond vehicles, any other major developments that you see in O9?
I think one of the bright spots for 2009 is going to be the scaling up of thin film solar manufacturing. So traditional solar cells are built around glass substrates. And thin film is a polymer-based substrate that can be printed on newspaper roll-to-roll printing presses. And we've got probably 5 to 10 gigawatts capacity that are going to come online within the U.S. alone. And then you're looking at several gigawatts of capacity coming online in Asia and Europe. So I think that solar is going to be one of the bright spots of 2009 in terms of alternative energy. Not to end on a bad note, but I think the two challenging stories of 2009 are going to be the conversation over coal and what we want to happen with coal versus what's the reality of our dependency on coal, and then the growing concern over peak oil production. I think that peak oil production is going to become a mainstream topic in the media in 2009.
Do you see nuclear power a move back in that direction as something that could gain some momentum in 2009, or is that still something that's farther off or not likely to happen?
I still think it's a little ways off. I think that the public is still, there's still a memory problem with the bad press of nuclear over the past 20, 30 years. If it does happen, it's not going to be driven by the U.S. You know, the U.S. has basically lost all its human talent when it comes to nuclear energy. And if we do end up scaling up our nuclear power plants, we're going to have to rely on, you know, French and Asian companies to do it. So I think the combination of those two things is going to make nuclear, you know, still a longer-term issue.
We have a lot of coal, too. Are we going to be able to use that in a clean and responsible manner? I mean, that, I guess that's
the challenge. Yeah, that's where algae comes into play. So this is the and I don't think that this idea is fully, you know, understood in the public yet, that algae is a carbon solution. Algae is a technology that takes carbon and makes it a resource. So algae eat carbon, and they use the power of sunlight to combine that carbon with hydrogen from water and produce a hydrocarbon fuel, basically. So if you see algae startups gaining momentum, that could prolong our dependency on coal.
Perhaps you could have an algae plant right next door to a coal-burning electric plant.
That's the idea, because those algae need large amounts of carbon to make it worth their while. So algae is a retrofitted technology for coal plants.
Interesting. That the connection between those two is not something that we've given much consideration to before,
yeah.
Stephen, on the program. I'm intrigued by that. That's one we're going to have to take a closer look at. Well, Gary, I think what we'll do now is let's shift gears away from energy, and we're going to move it back over to some more general predictions for 2009. And why don't I just I'll start with Aldous. I'll go alphabetical. Aldous, do you have some predictions you'd care to make? By the way, I don't mean to exclude energy. If you have energy, predictions you want to make, go ahead. And Gary will tell you where you get them wrong, I'm sure. But if you have other kinds of predictions you'd like to make, go for it.
No, I'm not going to be touching the energy realm with Gary on the call.
Okay.
I think we'll leave that to the expert. My field of expertise is, you know, more in social media and media in general. And I think one of the really interesting stories we'll see in 2009 is the ongoing rise of the prosumer. Duncan Riley at TechCrunch ago wrote about the rise of the prosumer, which is essentially a hybrid consumer and producer. You know, so anyone who's depositing blog content or you know, significant amounts of comments onto the web, you know, that's a prosumer, and it looks like we're reaching a real tipping point as far as people sharing their lives and cheap devices. You know, we have there's a sub $200 HD camera that's a flip cam that's going to go on the market very soon. This is going to enable a lot more people to put content onto the web, and then, you know, Google and all the other big boys are going to be tasked with monetizing that and returning value to people. I think as far as, you know, more broadly speaking, I think the economy will get worse. I think fundamentally underlying all of these economic problems and these business problems that I view more as symptoms is a fundamental misallocation of human capital. So we need to take a lot of the physicists and the PhDs that have followed, you know, the investment banking carrots, and we need to stick them into, you know, the jobs that produce the innovations that we need. And you know, that's kind of a very kind of basic example of that. But I think that, you know, that's going to become a more acknowledged storyline. People are going to realize that they have to fundamentally create more value as their, you know, accustomed way of living becomes more threatened. You know, as far as going out, you know, much more broadly, I like to think that, you know, if we're looking at a 10, 25-year span, whatnot, I think that the world is getting smarter. I think it's important to view the web as a big component and accelerator of our collective intelligence, and to view to view technology and communication and information as tools that we use to increase our ability to, you know, collectively survive and you know, be happy and to control our environment. And then to throw out a real wild card, you know, my final beyond prediction is that you know, sometime between, you know, 20 and 30 years from now, we'll realize that it's very possible we'll realize that we're actually living in a computer or a simulation, or that the universe is more akin to software than we currently believe, and that this will change the way that we think about physics and other natural laws. So there are my those are my four predictions. Some a little safer and some completely radical.
All I can say to that last one is, whoa, dude. actually, we've covered that one on this program a couple of times. We had a guy named Jim Alvajon. He's the author of the book The Universe Solved, and it takes kind of an entertaining look at the possibility that we might be living in a one big computer simulation. And of course, there are Nick Bosterman, you know, serious arguments about that as well. Interesting to consider how we would ever know that for sure. That might be a discussion for another day. But I have to say, Aldous, now you've stepped outside the ground rules of our discussion here, because I asked you for your 2008 predictions. You gave us all the way into the end of time. So when we get to the round robin, you're going to have to think of another long-term prediction.
Absolutely,
no problem.
Well, we'll have to do you last. Okay, how about you, Jeff? How about your predictions for 2009?
Well, I'll dovetail a little bit off of what Alvis was saying about the prosumer, which actually, you know, I think is emblematic of adoption to me in general, which you know, frequently I think one of the things that we do in terms of as futurists is talk about things that we think are gonna develop over time. Sometimes, you know, there's the Arthur C. Clarke expression, slower than you think, faster than you think. And, you know, just when you think that something's not going to happen, it starts happening. So one of the things, and I'm digressing, but one of the things that I would say that we'll see next year, which I don't feel like we've totally seen yet, is sort of mass adoption of Web 2.0. You know, I think that some of the factors are coming together now in terms of, you know, broadband penetration and, you know, the social networking tools that are making their way to the mainstream, and the dislocation I think that Alice was talking about in terms of, you know, the economy goes part and parcel with some of that. You know, the web is a big efficiency engine, and I think that's one of the real interesting battlegrounds that's going to, you know, play out even more next year is the land of media. A lot of people are predicting that we're going to see the demise of newspapers and I think, you know, what lies behind that is just the incredible efficiency, you know, of the web in terms of making things available cheap and you know, the connectivity trends. So I'll say widespread adoption of Web 2.0. I actually put a post up about some of these things on Future Blogger in terms of media predictions for next year. I think the future itself is going to be a very hot topic next year, increasingly. I think people are going to be turning towards it. Also, partially, you know, the convergence of, you know, a down economic times, you know, sort of the world redistributing resources through automation and the global economy is going to make people turn to the future, partially because things are not so great, at least here in the United States right now, and partially just because, as we all can talk about, you know, accelerating change and accelerating technological change, people are completely obsessed with, you know, the next gadget and the next greatest thing. So I think there's some media companies that are working on shows that are going to come out, and so I think the future is going to be a hot thing next year. And I think while I stay on social media, I think, you know, the other thing is I think Twitter is going to be a big one next year. I think it already is. I think it's going to take that jump from sort of, you know, the leading edge people and be the next step for, you know, from Facebook to Twitter, the thing that everybody's heard about. So I think that'll be a big thing that we see next year.
I think it's interesting when you think about people getting interested in the future when times aren't great. I guess when times are pretty good, you're too busy thinking about all the stuff you're doing, maybe. But I guess worry is intrinsically kind of future focused. So when things get bad, people start maybe directing their attention a little bit more towards the future.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of describing it.
And then if we can get their attention, we can let them know things aren't really as bad as they think, and they're actually perhaps even improving. It seems to me that people have to focus on the future. Just because it's coming so much faster than it ever did before. It's like present almost equals future anymore. It's a very odd world we live in. I wanted to ask one more question about the prosumer idea. And you talk about the death of the mainstream media. They seem to be in these kind of extended death throes. What's the economic impact of prosumerism? Are we going to be rolling all our own entertainment, all our own media, all our own information? And if so, is that going to have this like chilling effect on the economy for all the people who traditionally were paid to do those things?
Well, I think that it's a lot. You can look at robotics to draw parallels there. You know, a lot of people are predicting that robotics is going to displace a lot of labor, and for sure it's going to displace a ton of rote labor. And then those humans are going to need to figure out what to do to earn a living. And I think right now you can clearly see social media eroding very rapidly and increasingly so the revenue model for old media. Newspapers like the New York Times that will probably be sold next year. But at the same time, it doesn't look like these old media institutions are necessarily going to disappear. I think a lot of them are going to upgrade themselves, with social media tools, and that the ones that do are going to survive. You know, there are certain newspapers that will make it through to the era in which newspapers are all printed on OLEDs and are essentially websites that are just broadcast through a different type of screen that kind of feels like a newspaper. So I hope that answers some of that question.
Yeah, I think so. That makes it a lot more clear.
Well, this is Fast Forward Radio, and we have decided to go an hour and a half tonight. So if you'd like to contribute to the show, please join us in the text chat or leave a comment at the blog. Go ahead, Phil.
Okay. Well, I think we've rushed through everyone's 2009 predictions, except for we limited Gary to the topic of energy. So, Gary, if you have any non-energy related predictions for 2009,
yeah,
go ahead and share those.
I think I have a couple, some wild cards related to, you know, disruptions in Asia and kind of instability on that side. But, you know, on a positive note, I think the conversion to digital television is the great event of 2009. I think that's going to be, you know, that's the most understated event that is likely to happen, or that we know is going to happen in the social media space. So I think that we're going to see a number of successful startups, and then also incumbents using this digital platform for mainstream television to bring people onto the web. And building on top of that, I think that video and telepresence is set to explode in 2009. Over the holidays, we had my brother is traveling around Asia. He was in Cyprus, and we did a Skype conference, and he was in high definition video chatting with 12 of my relatives, and my parents sat there with their jaws dropped. They couldn't believe how clear the image was using this free application. So I think that the majority of web-based communication is going to start to shift from text to video, and I think 2009 is going to be a pivotal year for that.
You know, one of the things that, you know, is sort of a side benefit of moving to digital is a huge amount of the radio spectrum will be opened up.
Yep.
For things like Wi-Fi or whatever we need it for. So that's a side benefit of that.
So, yeah.
Maybe we can get fast-forward radio out on the radio, too.
I'm very excited, also just very excited about the interfaces that we could see in 2009 around, you know, I think touch is going to continue to expand on usability and standardization, and also voice. I think some of these early voice-based search applications are you know, very strong from, you know, in the beta format.
I think it's interesting to see those coming into play, kind of creeping up on us, where when you call the airline and 18 months ago you got this very pleasant person from obviously halfway around the world helping you out with making your airline reservation. Now you're dealing with this very pleasant robot, right, who's helping you make your reservation and actually doing a fairly good job of understanding the things that we're saying as we talk to them. You see more of that kind of thing as 2009 progresses?
Definitely. I think that I was going to say when I was listening to Gary talk about video, you know, it also made me think about that exact thing in terms of, voice translation, the fact that you see, you know, Google having voice search, you know, and something that I think the people have talked about for quite some time, you know, like a universal translator between languages, and something, you know, that I've thought about too from a productivity standpoint, and depending on, it's certainly something with, you know, people with disabilities and has lots of applications, is that, you know, really high fidelity, high accuracy, voice translation, so voice to text, and obviously what you were just saying. You know, it's the realism that you see when you do speak on the phone, and the inflection of the robot on the other side, and the algorithms that they use to pick up, you know, changes in your emotions and reactions and how they react to that is something that I think not just in 2009, but it's going to be a big theme for the next sort of 2 to 3, 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, I think to borrow a metaphor from CGI, I think we're almost approaching the uncanny valley of tech support or customer service, robotic customer service. You get to this moment where you almost ask them how the weather is. You know, it's, oh yeah, that's right. There's not actually somebody there. So, Jerry, any other things you're looking for in 09?
I think 09 is also going to be a big year for sensors. I think I'm very excited about IBM's involvement in pushing the idea that our world is, you know, increasingly instrumented, and that the number of things on the web, you know, that the web is becoming, you know, a network of objects. I think this idea that sensors, low-cost, low-power sensors, are going to change the world is going to become increasingly mainstream in 2009.
Very cool. Something else to look forward to. Okay, well, now we're going to extend our view a little bit, and we're going to look out into the world beyond the year 2009. And this one, I'm going to open it up, Stephen. We're all going to get to make a prediction here. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go around the horn with everyone giving me one, or even, you know, do a couple if you want to, long-term prediction, long 10 years, you know, 15, 25, 100 years, however far you want to go in any topic that you want to go. Elvis gave us a great example with the discovery that the universe is a computer simulation. So I'll start with Jeff. Give us your long-term view.
Okay. One prediction. I'm going to say I'm going to throw out actuarial escape velocity.
All right.
Which is awesome. Which is a term that that the first time I ever heard it became an instant fan of, and I'll throw out a prediction that we'll see it in the next 20 years, and you know, for people who don't know, I mean, actuarial escape velocity is when research adds more than a year of life extension to over the course of a year to the average person's life, and I think, you know, aging is going to be and healthier aging and assisted aging, and, you know, the advances that we make in biotechnology, there are all going to be huge societal themes in the next decade or so. So that'll be the one that I'll throw out there: actuarial escape velocity.
I want to throw out
one of our. Go ahead.
I want to throw out mine because it's related. I think the first generation of life extension technology is closer than most people realize. I think my prediction will be in the years we'll see the first generation of life extension technology, perhaps not labeled as such. Perhaps it'll be technology to, you know, treat diabetes or something like that, but that has the effect of extending life expectancy, ultimate life expectancy. So, but that's, of course, less than escape velocity, which will be on down the road. I'm hopeful that you're right in 20 years.
So, I'm sorry, Stephen, what was the time frame on yours?
7 years.
7 years, okay. So substantial progress in life extension in 7 years, and then actuarial escape velocity in 20 years. I'm liking those numbers. That works for me in a very big way. I think I can make 20 years. So I like those predictions. Okay. Aldous, have I given you enough time? You can give us another far-reaching, futuristic, into the beyond the year 2009 prediction.
Sure. This one's not quite as wowing as the realization that we're in a simulation, but I think it's maybe going to be even more significant. As all these technologies improve our ability to manipulate our environment, I think at the same time we're going to undergo a steady shift in the way we perceive ourselves. So my prediction is going to be that over the next, 5 to 20 years, we on the planet philosophically are going to go through an expanding sense of the self, or a sort of expansion of the term human, which will result in sort of a non-static humanism, which will then in turn, change the implications of humanistic and transhumanistic thinking. Once the system becomes more important or more at the forefront of our thinking and our empathy, then I think that's going to start to change the types of decisions that we collectively make.
Well, now I'm going to pick up on that one because I think a piece of that, I've actually got three I'm going to do. I know you can only do one, so I'm going to do three. There it is. As I was reviewing the top 50 stories for our Better All the Time review for the year, one thing that really struck me, and I didn't notice at the time, as I was cataloging these stories week in and week out, how many major breakthroughs we've seen over the year 2008 related to the human brain. Just all kinds of amazing stuff going on with our understanding of how the brain works. And so, Aldous, I think the kind of understanding that you're talking about it goes well beyond an enhanced understanding of the brain, but I think that we're getting to know ourselves a lot better as, you know, just kind of physical beings on the planet, and a huge piece of that is that we're coming to understand the brain a lot better. So actually, I don't suppose I have a prediction on that. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that what you're talking about sounds a lot like what Kevin Kelly calls the quantified self, and I think this is an underlying dynamic that kind of permeates all futures. From my perspective, is this idea of quantification, and so my hunch long term is that quantification is going to reveal how intricately we are symbiotic with our environment and how we really are part and parcel of that. So I would just argue or qualify that is a gradual series of steps. If 2009 is a big year of sensing, as Gary pointed out, that sensing is going to help quantify the planet, and then it's going to help us quantify our brains, and then over time we kind of get to see how deep the rabbit hole really goes.
Okay, well, there it is. So that's my prediction. We're going to quantify the grant. 1 of 3. Okay, the other two real fast. Stephen's reminding me in the back channel that we're running low on time. What I call cancer contained. All right, so this is a prediction for medicine. I think we are a decade or less away from having cancer, worst case being a disease that people deal with the way they currently deal with diabetes. We see tremendous progress being made in cancer treatment across the board, and I think that's going to be either it's wiped out completely. I'll make that a kind of a two-parter. Either it's wiped out completely, or we've got it contained to the extent that people deal with it the way they currently deal with these kind of conditions that people have learned, chronic conditions that people have learned to live with. And finally, my third prediction is what I call my retirement cruise, and I'll provide a link to that. It's on YouTube. Albus was kind enough to video me talking about my retirement cruise at Convergence 08. And that takes us to Gary for his beyond 2009 prediction.
Okay, I'm going to put on my different hat, avoid energy. But so I think the area of space is very interesting to be like 10 years out. So I would say within 10 years, we're going to have high-definition images, kind of robot telepresence images from the moon and from suborbital space. So I think high-definition images. And then within 10 years, I think people like Oprah, Bono, Angelina Jolie, and all those celebrities are going to have their first suborbital experience. So that would be my, which I think are all profound concepts. And then if I went further out, 25 years, maybe a little longer, I think we're going to see resource extraction. So asteroid mining could be something that's forced upon the global economy. And then actual construction of space-based manufacturing and energy production, like the Dyson Sphere. So I think those things are probably 20, 35 years out.
You could combine a couple of those things. Oprah give do a show for suborbital space. High-definition video.
I'm looking forward to it.
The era of the space-based prosumer.
Exactly. Tom Cruise can really jump up and down on the couch up there. Low gravity, right? So, by the way, I love that phrase, suborbital experience. I love the, predicting that people are going to have that. It's, I don't know, vaguely suggestive somehow, isn't it? I hear that and go, wow, I kind of like to have a suborbital experience. I don't know about anybody else. Okay, so
it's like a 10-mile high club.
Right.
I didn't want to say it. I'm so glad someone said that. We've talked about the recent past. We've talked about the near future. We talked far into the more distant future. So, Jeff, could you just sort of summarize for us why you think something like MemeBox is important for these kinds of discussions and for people who are interested in these kinds of issues?
Yeah, I would say I think that it comes down to that it's translative and that it elevates the level of conversation and brings together a bunch of great thinkers and makes their work accessible and I think that because of accelerating change and the pace of accelerating change and the way that the world is coming together. I think it's just an important platform for that, and I think you can look at it both ways. I tend to be more of an optimist and slightly a techno-optimist than I am a pessimist, but I think that there's so much fascinating stuff going on these days that it doesn't matter which side of that fence you're on, that a platform like MemeBox is just is a fascinating place for people to come together and explore the future.
Absolutely. And Albus, the last question on this to you. Do you think that MemeBox and sites like Future Blogger, do they have a role to play in actually shaping the future? And if so, what role would you say that is?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that throughout human history, and probably before that, throughout biological history, life on Earth has gotten better at simulating the present at creating, you know, histories, whether those are in their DNA or in their little brains that have now gotten much bigger. You know, simulating those two in order to create a better simulation of the future. You know, just so a human can learn to navigate a street and not get hit by cars. I mean, collectively, we have to figure out ways to not get hit by killer asteroids or to kill ourselves along the way. And I think that through the web, I think that we can structure information in such a way that we can build out our visions of the simulation and therefore of systems in such a way that it helps us make the most optimal steps moving forward. You know, I think it's just I think it's part of a broader process of the web helping us to all become smarter. And I think that by having a targeted place like Memebox explicitly dedicated to future focused ideas, I think that helps humans en masse understand where, you know, where to draw those ideas most quickly and then to use them wherever applicable. It just increases the speed at which we can, you know, together navigate the future. And by no means is that limited to Memebox. I mean, The Speculist and, you know, Wired and then all sorts of, you know, applications and services and voices that have yet to spring onto the scene are also going to, I think, play a big role in this this bettering.
You see this kind of conversation going on. It's great that there are so many voices entering into it. And I think going back to the prediction about, you know, are more people going to be interested in the future, in the near future, it certainly seems to me that there are because there's so much interest in and participation in things like in things like Memebox and Future Blogger and all the different kinds of tools that you're offering for people. So it's exciting stuff, and it's great having the chance to talk with you all about that tonight. Now we're going to shift gears, and we're going to switch it on back to our 2-to-1 contest. And as you'll recall, at the beginning of the program, I read 3 news stories. 2 of them are real. 1 of them is made up. And we're now going to collect everyone's responses as to which one is the real one, which one is the made-up story. So, Michael, actually, I'm going to start with you. Did we get any responses in the chat room, and or do you have anything? Oh, before I ask, let me just remind everyone what the 3 stories were. 1 was MIT using nanorobots to fight cancer and AIDS. 2 was scientists discovering true love in human beings. And 3 was crabs counting their steps to find their way back home. 2 of those are real. 1 is fake. Michael.
Yeah, we got some good response in the chat room. M.W. Meadows thought that the crab story was the fake one. And I don't know the exact reasoning, but that was his vote. Harvey raised the issue that the scientists finding true love and pinning it down creates a testing problem, because how do you confirm that? I think the rest of the comments that got made I lost because I can't scroll back up to that beginning part of the chat. But it was it seemed like the crabs were perhaps winning. I'm going to agree with the crab one, and my thinking is this. Crabs maybe have a way to find their way back home, but it's not by counting their steps, because that's an internally based reference, and it would be, a poor strategy compared to some external reference like turtles navigating by the stars. So the chat room is leaning towards the crabs being the fake ones.
Okay, all right. Chat room has gone on record, and they say 3 is our fake story. I'm going to turn it around to our panel now, and we'll start with Gary. Gary, of those 3 stories, which do you think didn't quite ring true to you?
I think the MIT, the nano robots. I think they're nano delivery mechanisms, but if there was a robot, an actual mechanical element to that story, I think that's the false one.
Okay, so we've got 1 vote against the crabs and 1 vote against the nano robots. Jeff, what do you think?
I'm gonna go with Gary on that one. I think they all sound very real and plausible to me, but That's the point towards the end, talking about the delivery of that. That, and also I think it's the least obvious of them all. It's the one that sounds most authoritative. So I'm gonna go with the MX.
So the one that sounds the most authoritative is the most suspicious by that reckoning. Very interesting. Very good. All right, Alvis, what do you think?
Well, I'm gonna have to break with the meme box consensus and call bluff on the self, propelled nano robotics in the bloodstream. I think that one's real. I think it's meant to be a red herring. But based on how long that description was, I tend to think that that would be a lot of effort to go into. And in which case, if Phil, if you really did write that whole segment, I'm very, very impressed. I'll
have to say, Alvis, can I just say, I'm loving the meta-analysis here on 2-to-1. Wonderful stuff. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I'm going to go with the public and say crabs, because I think that counting steps is a bad thing, especially if you're in water and one of your steps could be longer than another step. That reeks of not true to me. Let's find out.
Okay, so we got another vote for the crabs. Stephen, you can be the tiebreaker and be the one to part company and say no, that true love thing is fake. Or what do you think?
Okay, I think the first story is true. I think I actually read that. Now, when they say nanorobot, they're probably meaning something that's more closer to being biological than mechanical. But yeah, I believe the first one's true. I got to say that the second one is true, because I've been with the same woman now 19 years. And
well, there you go.
I for my own health, I have to say that number two is true. And so I'm going to say, along with the chat room and a couple of others, that it's the crab story that's not true.
Okay. Well, there it is. So no one is voting no on true love, and that is a wonderful, life-affirming, heartwarming thing. Point that out. So we've got two that look suspicious to different parts of our audience for different reasons. We've got the how crabs find their way home, are they really counting their steps to get home, and is MIT actually using nanorobots to fight cancer and AIDS? And the winner is number one. That is the made-up story. Gary, your analysis was absolutely right. And in fact, this is a real news story that I rewrote a little bit. Alvis, to answer your question about who would go to all this trouble, I'll get a real story and add a little bit of the amazing to it. And what I did was, in fact, what's happening at MIT is they are using nanoparticles, they are using molecules, but there is no robotic element involved. And Gary, your BS detector was right on the money there. You spotted that. All of the electronics, all the control mechanism is exterior to the patient. They don't currently have anything that would work inside the patient as a robot. I think that it's an entirely plausible story, even in 2009 perhaps, but it's not true today. So that was our winning false story. The other two are true. True love is real, and it sounds like some of our would-be intelligent designers of the universe would have evolved crabs differently and had them use some other mechanism, but in fact, crabs find their way home by counting their steps, according to the research done by, did I get his name here, John Blaine, as reported in Current Biology. So what do you make of
Well, I got it wrong. Well, that's okay, though. I'll be here next week to try to get it right. So, oh well.
Yeah, we found the only way to make these plausible is to take real stories and mess with them a little bit. Or you can do what Michael Darling did last week, which was he took three true stories and made them all impossible. Made it impossible for anybody to find the winning answer, since they were all true. Okay, well, that is going to do it. Gentlemen, we thank you so very much for being with us this evening, and we look forward to tracking the progress of Memebox and Future Blogger, and we look forward to having you on the program again sometime in the very near future.
It was our pleasure, Phil and Stephen. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Thank you. All right, Stephen, what do you got for us for music?
The song's name is Atmospheric, and the artist's name is Mark Emmons. And I thought it was very appropriate, so give it a listen.
All right, Atmospheric by Mark Emmons. Stephen, thank you for putting that together. Michael and all the friends in the chat room, thanks for hanging in with us. Everyone listening, we look forward to being with you again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.